This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Today is Wednesday, March 3rd, 2021. On this day in 1983, musician Peter Ivers was found bludgeoned to death in his downtown Los Angeles loft. The police never arrested any suspects, and the murder remains unsolved. Welcome to Today in True Crime, a Spotify original from Parcast. I'm Vanessa Richardson, and today I'm joined by our guest host, Richard Rossner, host of the Spotify original from Parcast, Unexplained Mysteries. Every Tuesday and Thursday, he and his co-host Molly investigate the greatest mysteries of history and life on Earth. He's here to discuss some of the historical aspects of today's story while I'll cover the narrative. Due to the graphic nature of today's crimes, listener discretion is advised. Extreme caution is advised for children under 13.
Hello, everyone. I'm intrigued to dive into the life and murder of musician Peter Ivers.
Absolutely. Now, let's go back to Los Angeles on March 3rd, 1983, around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. A spring rain was falling when Jim Tucker got a phone call about his neighbor, Peter Ivers. The 36-year-old musician and television host hadn't been heard from all day. His friend, Ann Ramis, was afraid he'd gotten into a car accident because of the weather. She asked Jim to go across the hall to Peter's loft and make sure everything was okay. Jim hung up and walked over to Peter's place. Their building was a barely converted warehouse in downtown LA's Little Tokyo, just a few blocks from Skid Row. Security was lax, and some of the residents had suffered a fair share of break-ins. One of them had even left a wooden mallet in the communal kitchen, just in case someone needed protection from an unwelcome intruder. Despite this, Peter often left his door unlocked, and even when he didn't, all it took was a little jimmying to get it open. Jim got inside Peter's apartment and saw Peter lying in bed in the far corner of the loft. But as Jim got closer, he realized that his neighbor was covered in blood. He'd been bludgeoned to death, and the weapon was the wooden hammer lying nearby. Shaken, Jim called the paramedics. Then he went outside to wait for them. As he waited for them to show up, he let another neighbor know what he'd just seen. The neighbor decided he had to take a look for himself and went right into the apartment with some friends. Others followed. By the time patrol officers showed up, they had to kick people out and do their best to preserve the crime scene. But it was already too late. People had been popping in and out ever since the body was discovered. The crime scene was hopelessly contaminated. By the time detectives showed up, it was, in their words, absolute chaos. It seemed that Peter Ivers had a lot of friends, and they all seemed drawn to the murder site. 40 people had been in and out of the loft all day. One of them was Ann Ramis, the woman who'd called Tucker and asked him to check on Peter. She turned up with her husband, Harold, the screenwriter of Animal House and director of National Lampoon's Vacation. Anne seemed extremely distraught. The detectives wondered if she and Peter were having an affair, so much so that her husband, Harold, fell under immediate suspicion. But Harold's alibi checked out. The police realized they were dealing with a burglary gone wrong. Stereo equipment was missing, and drug use in the area was rampant. They figured a drug addict had come in looking for something to steal. Peter had simply been in the wrong place at the wrong time. It all sort of made sense, but one person wasn't satisfied. Peter's 33-year-old ex-girlfriend, Lucy Fisher, knew something didn't add up. As she spoke to the police, she grew more frustrated at their insistence that this was the doings of a random addict. She could tell that they might let the case go cold, and she was determined not to let that happen. So 5 weeks after Peter's murder, she hired a private detective named David Charbonneau and asked him to start the investigation all over. She wanted him to talk to everyone Peter knew. She was determined to learn the truth, no matter what. Coming up, we'll look at Peter Ivers' struggle to make it in Hollywood and how he may have met his end. You discover their practices, seek their advice, and let yourself become more vulnerable than ever before. They have the ability to heal what the doctors can't, or so they say. Hi, listeners. It's Vanessa from the podcast series Cults. Be sure to check out our 4-part special on miracle healers airing right now. Meet figures from around the world who claimed powers and pushed remedies, but harbored more sinister intentions. You don't want to miss it. And if you're looking for more episodes on the most radical and deadly groups in history, tune in to Cults every Tuesday. From Jim Jones and the People's Temple, to Charles Manson and the Manson family, to Keith Raniere and NXIVM, you'll uncover the unscrupulous methods used to turn bright-eyed recruits into die-hard believers. Follow the Spotify original from Parcast, Cults, free on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the story. On March 3, 1983, musician and television host Peter Ivers was found bludgeoned to death in his downtown LA loft. Based on the rampant crime in the area and the fact that Peter's stereo equipment was missing, the cops believed it was a burglary gone wrong. To them, it seemed like just another unsolvable homicide. But Peter's ex-girlfriend, Lucy Fisher, didn't believe it was a random burglary, so she hired a private detective. My guest host, Richard, is going to take over from here to discuss Peter's struggle for fame in LA, the unusual crowd he ran in, and the search to find his killer.
Thanks, Vanessa. Peter Ivers was born in Illinois in 1946, but raised in Brookline, Massachusetts. He was a certified genius who attended Harvard and studied Greek and Latin. But in his sophomore year, he began playing harmonica. Soon, he was so good, he was being called a virtuoso. A number of performances led to his first record deal with Epic Records, and an album debuted in 1969. It was a flop, but Peter didn't give up. He moved to L.A. with his college girlfriend, Lucy Fisher, to keep pursuing a career in music. He turned to scoring movies for Harvard friends beginning to direct. In the meantime, he got another record deal, this time from Warner Brothers, and released 2 more albums. In 1976, he even opened for Fleetwood Mac. But his music was more new wave than soft rock, and it failed to catch on. It also didn't help that his performances were pretty out there. Sometimes he took to the stage wearing a diaper and nothing else. But one thing Peter excelled at was making friends. All kinds of people were drawn to him, from hardcore punks to Hollywood actors and directors. He was as comfortable hanging out with writers from Harvard Lampoon as he was scoring a movie for David Lynch. In 1982, he began to host an underground cable access show called New Wave Theater. It featured acts too edgy for MTV, like the Dead Kennedys and Fear. Peter's job was to stand in front of the camera and basically spout stream of consciousness in Ray-Bans. The show eventually found a cult following, but it had a liability. Its creator, David Jove, a Canadian director, with a shady past. He wrote, produced, and directed the show and considered himself a visionary. But his personality was alienating at best and terrifying at worst. He had a hair-trigger temper, an enormous ego, and abused cocaine. He also was known to carry a gun. Anyone who knew better stayed far away. But Peter was able to adapt to Jove's menacing style, and he made the partnership work. But as the show went national, Peter's relationship with Lucy started to fray. They broke up, and he moved into a loft downtown. This concerned some of his close friends because the neighborhood was in no way safe. However, Peter wasn't bothered. He loved his new place, and the building he moved into felt like a true artist's colony. And yet, as 1983 dawned, Peter began to crave more mainstream success. He knew it was time to get serious about a real career, one that could make him some actual money. He'd been living on loans from family and friends for too long. Luckily, his wide-ranging contacts were starting to pay off. Through a friend, he was about to sign a songwriting contract for ATV Records, and a movie treatment he'd co-written about a sci-fi Alexander the Great was optioned by Warner Brothers. Things were looking up for Pete. All he had to do was tell David Jove he was leaving. But it's unclear whether he ever did. Then, he was found dead. On March 3rd, 1983, Peter's friends dropped in, one by one, at the crime scene. David Jove was one of them. As soon as he got there, he took one of the detectives aside and seemed to be charming him. Then, he slipped into the loft and, according to some witnesses, made off with one of Peter's bloody blankets. As if this wasn't strange enough, he then began to insert himself into the investigation. He reportedly fed the police all kinds of theories of what might have happened. Some believe this was to keep them off his tail. One of his theories was that Peter had somehow gotten himself killed by drug dealers after an ecstasy deal gone bad. Interestingly, this theory may be true. Lucy's private eye, David Charbonneau, gained access to Peter's diary, and it seemed to allude to a deal up in San Francisco. A deal that frightened Peter, but that he had to go along with for money. Strangely, the diary went missing after Lucy fired Charbonneau, and he handed it over to the police. As for Jove, the LAPD never found any physical evidence to link him to the crime. But the crime scene, as we know, had never been actually secured. In his heart of hearts, Charbonneau always suspected David Jove. But Jove died in 2004 from cancer, and the truth died with him. As of this recording, Peter's murder remains unsolved.
I'm Vanessa Richardson. Thanks again, Richard, for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. You can find Unexplained Mysteries on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts.
And for more stories like this one, check out the Spotify original from Parcast, Unsolved Murders. Today in True Crime is a Spotify original from Parcast. You can find more episodes of Today in True Crime and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify. We'll be back with a brand new episode tomorrow in True Crime. Today in True Crime is a Spotify original from Parcast. It is executive produced by Max Cutler, sound designed by Juan Borda, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Bruce Kitovich. This episode of Today in True Crime was written by Joanna Philbin, with writing assistance by Alex Benedon, fact-checking by Cheyenne Lopez, and stars Richard Rossner and Vanessa Richardson.